chats from the Blog Cabin.
This is your favorite time of the week with your number one podcast.
Hey y'all, it's Melissa. I know the holidays are crazy and we're actually going to be dealing with family members that are dysfunctional family members, and it's hard because sometimes you have to be with family members even though you don't want to be. The next two episodes are going to be about dealing with family members during the holidays. This particular one is called, I'm entitling, It's Not Your Fault. It's actually from her book, and I am chatting with an author, Laura Connell, who I had an amazing conversation with. I originally had planned for this episode to go up last week, but, you know, time got away from me. But this particular one, we dive into what is called the family scapegoat and what it is and how we can overcome being the stuff that family puts on us that we have to do, we feel obligated to do. So I really hope you enjoy this episode and look forward to hearing your comments about it. So until then, bye.
Come join Melissa and her guests on the Chats from the Blog Cabin podcast. From North Carolina, this podcast will have you feeling like you've known these folks for years. Listen in as they chat about life, culture, current events, and more, all with a special Southern flair. Curl up with your favorite beverage and get ready to be entertained. Tune in now for a unique experience that's fun and insightful.
Hey y'all, welcome back to another episode of Chats in the Blog Cabin. You know, the show where I virtually invite people into the Blog Cabin to chat about life and other things. And today we're chatting about a topic that I know people are going to need to hear around the holiday season. And that's being around a dysfunctional family and, you know, being just everything basically about this. I mean, this book in the press release, it says it was impactful. And yes, it is impactful because I'm like halfway through it. Because I'm digesting it in little pieces. But oh my gosh, I think I even tagged you on an Instagram post about the butterfly in the cocoon. And I was like, She is reading my mind. She's writing my story. What is all this about? So Laura, welcome to the show. And tell us a little bit about yourself before we start into the book.
Sure. Well, thank you. I did see that Instagram post and that really touched my heart. I love to hear that, how the book has impacted you. I'm grateful for that. And me, I am an author, obviously, with the book, and a trauma-informed coach. So in the book, It's Not Your Fault, I do what I do in my work, which is to help people understand the connection between their adult self-sabotage or the ways that they hold themselves back and their childhood trauma. Because a lot of people think that, they blame themselves, that they think they're bad people, they think they're stupid, whatever. And really, everything that's going on is related to trying to cope with the pain that they felt in their childhood. So they're using the same coping skills they developed as children to survive. They're bringing those same skills into adulthood where they become very maladaptive. And there are lots of ways this shows up in our relationships, in our work life, with friends, and of course, with family. In our relationship with ourselves too. So my life's work, I guess, is just helping people to recognize that link, to stop blaming themselves, to have compassion for themselves, and in that way, overcome and have a life that is more authentic to them and where they feel like they're really creating a life they love instead of just reacting and surviving to what they see as threats. And this all started in childhood.
So how did you get involved in this type of work?
Yeah, well, for me, it started in childhood because I had a very difficult upbringing. I grew up in a very dysfunctional home, so a lot of emotional abuse and neglect. I had a narcissistic mother who had an undiagnosed mental illness, and she was very abusive to me, but behind closed doors. So the image that was presented to the world was very different than what I saw behind closed doors. And then my father, on the other hand, was very emotionally neglectful. And so he didn't really do anything to protect me. He was very critical of me, in fact, didn't really pay attention to me. So that was the dynamic in the home. And I always just felt very much alone. Like I didn't have anyone on my side. I really had to fend for myself. And that's where my coping skills started. That's where I started to develop these self-defeating habits that I now realize really kept me alive in childhood. Because when you're a child and your parents reject you or abandon you, it does feel like life or death. It feels like you could die because they're in charge of taking care of you. So that's how your body responds to this parental abuse and neglect. And then, of course, like I said, carry that into my adulthood. So I had started around age 19 doing therapy to try and understand and get along with my mother, not knowing that she's a narcissist and it's really not possible to have a relationship with a narcissist. And I had therapists who really didn't understand the dynamic, and all they did was try to help me have a relationship with my mother. And they didn't really get to the bottom of the issue. They dealt with symptoms. So I think they saw my behavior and really did think there was maybe something wrong with me, that I just needed to behave differently. I needed to think differently, and then everything would be fine. So I would use these tactics, like changing my behavior and my thoughts, and that might help for a short time. But there wasn't a change inside of me. So it was just kind of pretending to be someone that I wasn't. And as soon as I relaxed and let go of those, you know, that behavior modification and the thought control that I was doing, I would just go right back into my old patterns. So it wasn't until much later, I'd say probably in the last decade, when I started to make this connection between my childhood trauma and my adult outcomes, and learning that there is actually a lot of research and evidence to show that there is a strong connection there. So when I found out that, I got to educating myself about that, on that topic, everything I could find. I ended up working with a trauma-informed coach for 3 months, got further in that 3 months than I did with all the decades of therapy before that.
Wow.
Really inspired me to pursue trauma-informed coaching myself and try to give people what I had found. So that in a nutshell is how I got here.
So what exactly is trauma-informed coaching?
Yeah, it is a form of coaching that takes into account how trauma has impacted the individual. So it's not going to look at your self-sabotage as something that can be fixed by willpower or better habits or something like that. It's going to recognize the role of trauma, how trauma is stored in the body, how the mind and the thoughts are nothing compared to how the body feels. That's where the truth lies, is in the body. So if you try to talk yourself out of something with logic, that's not really going to work. The body kind of wins in this situation. And it's telling you, if your body's telling you I'm no good, and your mind is trying to use all this evidence to say you are good, it's not going to work. It just doesn't. So that's just one example of this, the difference between just regular coaching and trauma-informed coaching. A trauma-informed coach will also be able to recognize maybe when someone's in like a fight or flight response or a freeze response, and have some things they can do to calm the nervous system and so on. So that's an example.
Wow. And it's like I said, this book was very impactful. I think the biggest thing that I wrote, a couple of notes, of course, I highlighted a lot of the books, but talking about being a people pleaser, a recovering people pleaser, toxic people, toxic family, scapegoats, all that. I'm like, yes, 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 check more and more and more. And I'm sure as I get more into the book, I will definitely see more things. But how do we navigate that during the holidays? Because that's big. A lot of people are around family members that normally they can kind of, you know, keep at arm's length during the year. But when holidays come around, they have to be around family. So How do you navigate that?
Yeah, well, I would even challenge whether we have to be around family. Mm-hmm. I'm not. But I do understand what you mean, because it's taken me a long time to get to the point where I cannot be with my family at Christmas and not feel that's the end of the world and all of that. So if you do feel you have to be around your family, this Christmas, I would suggest setting boundaries. And of course, we all have heard that dreaded word boundaries. Mm-hmm. And if you have grown up in a dysfunctional family, they can be incredibly difficult to set. And again, that is to do with that nervous system response, that feeling like it's a life or death situation, that you please these people. Of course, pleasing people means not having boundaries of your own. But I think you can start with how do I feel in my body, and connecting with yourself instead of abandoning yourself and just looking to what other people want. So that to me would be the start, just paying attention to what's going on in your body. And do you need to take a deep breath at this point? You know, slow the breathing down. Do you need to give yourself like a loving touch, you know, whether it's like your heart or your tummy, or just touch the tops of your legs sometimes? Even touching your face can be very soothing. Just things that you can do to remind yourself that you are there for yourself, because it is so easy when you grow up in one of these families to just forget about yourself and just do everything you can to please the other person, which, by the way, never works anyway. And you just end up feeling really depleted, really exhausted, really unfulfilled. And it's the same old thing that has always happened. Another thing you can do is put boundaries around your time. So instead of, you know, if you're one who feels you have to spend the night or even a few nights if your parents or whoever are out of town, don't do that. You know, either go home or stay at a hotel. You might want to not spend the whole day, just come before dinner and just stay a little bit after dessert. Even that can help, because you know that you just have this few hours that you have to be there, and you can kind of attend to yourself through that. But if you get into this pattern of spending hours and hours and days in a place where you don't feel supported, you don't feel loved, you have to abandon yourself, that's not going to go well. And another way I would say to set boundaries is with your finances. So if you're used to overextending, again, to try and please people or to prove that you're a good person or whatever the reason it is, and then come January, you're in debt or you are just completely overextended, put boundaries around that. Give yourself a budget and commit and say, I'm not going to spend over this. Maybe just buy for the children, you know, don't buy for the adults, things like that. These are ways you can set boundaries that are kind of baby steps and doable for someone who's not used to setting boundaries.
That's some really great advice. And we have to take a brief commercial break, but we'll be right back with more from Laura.
People welcomed me, and they knew the pain of the journey that we'd been on because they'd been there too.
Other Parents Like Me is an online community, peer-led, for parents with kids struggling with mental health and or substances.
It's a space that's safe. It feels like I can actually share what's going on.
We offer 15 daily support groups per week and live speaker talks on Thursdays, as well as a monthly expert panel.
We also have a resource hub that has a toolkit. This includes over 1,000 articles, podcasts. There's a glossary with the most recent and relevant terms. And we have a directory that's been vetted.
The overwhelming feeling when we're sitting in a meeting and I'm telling my story and I see others shaking their head, tears falling. You know, they understand this roller coaster and they're along for the ride.
Are you ready for an exciting adventure in the world of do-it-yourself projects? Join me on Market.live and get ready to be inspired by the DIY show hosted by yours truly, Melissa from Chats in the Block Cabin. This is your chance to unlock your creativity and bring your imagination to life. Imagine the satisfaction of transforming ordinary objects into something extraordinary. Get ready to learn new skills and discover how easy it can be to create something unique that reflects your own personal style. The DIY Show is here to guide you every step of the way, providing you with tips, tricks, and ideas that will make your project a success. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity. Grab your friends, family, or even your furry companions and tune in
to the DIY Show on Market.live on Mondays at noon Eastern Standard Time, or you can catch the replay. Together, let's unleash our inner artists and embark on a journey filled with joy, inspiration, and endless possibilities. Get ready for a show like no other, where creativity knows no bounds. See you there.
And we are back chatting with Laura, the author of It's Not Your Fault, The Subconscious Reasons We Self-Sabotage and How to Stop It. Now, I want to talk to you about a couple of things in the book. One is you talk about your mom, and you talk about how your mom would call you at work and berate you. How do we stop that process? Because a lot of times, like here, you know, like when you're writing or when you're doing anything creative or basically working, and someone comes into our little boundary space, how do we stop that from affecting our work?
Yeah. And that was the thing. At the time, it would affect the rest of my day because my mother had such an impact on my nervous system, because it was that inner child inside of me who was not healed yet and who really felt like my mother had the power to end me, basically. And that if she wasn't happy with me, my body really felt like I could die. You know, that was the feeling. It was shaky. It was not being able to concentrate, having a fierce need to make things right with her, which of course would mean abandoning myself again. And the way to not let that affect you is really to heal the inner child. So it's to know that you're a grown up and your mother doesn't have the power to end you. In fact, now she doesn't have any power over you at all, because you're an adult, you have a job, that's where she's calling you, in fact. You can put a roof over your head, you can go to the grocery store and get food. These are all the things you couldn't do as a kid, so you were really dependent on that parent. And that's where all these feelings started. They were very real, and you can see how they make sense, because as a child, you are in a lot of trouble if your parent is not there for you, if they're not going to provide for you, all of that stuff that you fear. But now as an adult, you can take care of yourself. So it is giving that child inside of you, because like I said, that logic is not enough. You can't only tell yourself that. Mm-hmm. You have to attend to that inner child. So that child is hurting. That child feels left alone, and it feels responsible for keeping you alive. But it doesn't know how, because it doesn't have any skills. It's just a little child. So what you can do is let that child know, I'm here for you. I'm taking care of you because I'm the adult now, and you don't have to do that anymore. And you can even thank it. You can say, thank you for doing that for me up until now. I know how much you love me and care for me, but I've got it from here. And you can just go and play, or you can go find something fun for us to do. And that's part of the inner child healing.
Now, what happens in the situation with the family where there's like a gap in like ages with siblings, so that the two older siblings are treated better by one parent than the two younger ones are, you know, that kind of dynamic? How does that work?
Yeah, well, I don't know if the way siblings are treated always has to do with birth order. Because often in a narcissistic family, so family with a narcissistic parent like mine, often there is a golden child and a scapegoat, but that's not necessarily correlated to birth order. And it's not necessarily always true that there will be a golden child and a scapegoat. There might be one and not the other, or there might not be any of those. So I don't know. I'm not an expert on birth order. I don't know how much it plays into this. But I do know oldest children are at most risk of being parentified. I was an oldest child, parentified, which means that you were given tasks that were something the parent should have done, whether that was giving the parent emotional support and not having emotional support for you, or whether it was things like having to make dinner when you were really little. It can be physical things like tasks, or it can be emotional things like giving your parents, you know, your parents telling you things that aren't appropriate for a child to know, things like that. And then I've heard that the middle children tend to get lost in the shuffle, like they don't get the attention that they need. So they might be more of a lost child who doesn't feel like they're part of the family as much. And then the youngest child would have its own issues of, you know, being babied and things like that. But like I said, I'm not an expert on birth order. Those are just a few, you know, little things that I know about that I've experienced and that I've seen.
So you talk about the golden child and the scapegoat. Let's give the characteristics of each one.
Yeah. So the scapegoat is the one I know a lot about. I was a scapegoat in my family. And like I said, normally it's because there's a narcissistic parent at the helm. So the scapegoat is the one who really takes all the blame for the problems in the family. So the family doesn't want to face the truth of whatever is going on with them. Sometimes this can even include criminal activity, but other times it's just dysfunctional stuff. Like they don't know how to deal with their feelings. They don't know how to talk about things. So the scapegoat is the one who wants to tell the truth about things. They want to be emotionally honest. And what they don't realize is that the family does not want any of that because they have secrets to keep. And if you are a person wanting to get to the bottom of things and tell the truth about things, that is very inconvenient for a dysfunctional family. So what they're going to do is try to make you wrong. So they're going to suppress you. They're going to silence you. And often they use gaslighting to do that. And what gaslighting is really telling you that what you see with your own eyes or what you feel is has no validation. Like you're wrong, basically. That didn't happen. They can rewrite history or make reality something that it isn't, which becomes very confusing to the scapegoat and makes them start to doubt themselves. And another thing they do is that instead of dealing with the problem, so the scapegoat can be very abused, very maligned, very criticized, all of that stuff. And as soon as they have a normal human reaction to that, whether they get angry or whether they say, hey, why are you doing this to me? All of a sudden they get called crazy. So you're crazy. Look at your reaction instead of the real issue, which is what's being done to them. So that's a form of gaslighting too. And all it does is just distract the family from the real issues that they don't want to face. Because a family like this needs, they really need what we call a crisis. They need that in order to change, but they don't want to change. They don't want to face the crisis. So they're going to do everything they can to deny that anything is wrong. So instead they pick one person, a scapegoat, and say, you're wrong, we're right. If it weren't for you, everything would be fine.
So how do we get and cope with being the scapegoat for the family? Because obviously whatever you say, it's never, they're never going to listen, or they're not going to take in consideration feelings or anything else. Yeah. So how can the scapegoat be healthy mentally and emotionally because they're not getting it from their family?
Yeah. Well, very often the scapegoat will have to leave, at least for a time, in order to heal from what the family is dishing out to them. So they have to learn to tell a story about themselves that is rooted in reality instead of what their family has brainwashed them to believe, because they've really been conditioned often since childhood to believe something about themselves that is not true. So the family, like I said, has used them as kind of a dumping ground for all their problems. They're like the garbage bin of the family. It can be really, really toxic sometimes and leave the scapegoat feeling like they're so alone. They're so scared of the world. They feel like they're unlovable. They feel like there's something wrong with them. So they need to sometimes get away from the family in order to realize, like, no, none of these things are true. This is just what you've been told, so the family can continue with their own narrative. So it's telling the truth about themselves and learning to believe there's nothing wrong with them. Actually, they have many gifts that the family was afraid of. And that's why those gifts were framed as bad things instead of what they really are, which is gifts.
I love that. And I'm writing that down. Mm-hmm. Because you don't think about it like that. You don't think about the gifts that family are afraid of. Mm-hmm. You think, what's wrong with me? Why can't they love me? Why can't they do this? Why can't they do that? But now framing into that positive, just that little positive thought, can retrain your brain to think totally something different.
Yeah, absolutely. And And to know that there is nothing you can do or say to make them understand you, that is very empowering too. That's often the turning point for the scapegoat when they finally realize, actually, nothing I do or say is going to change what they think of me, and I have to be at peace with that. That's very difficult when you've spent your whole life trying to prove your goodness to people who will never see it, who are really invested in not seeing it, and to accept that this is a system, it has nothing to do with you, and nothing you do is going to make you the good guy in their eyes. You got to let that go.
And another thing you hit on in the chapter, I keep saying, going back to scapegoating, because that's like the hugest impact. You talk about how the family for the scapegoat will talk bad about the scapegoat to other people to make them want to believe that same narrative. How can we go about rewriting that narrative for ourselves?
Yeah, and that's why when you're healing from scapegoating, you want to be careful who you tell about what you're going through, because not everybody understands these dynamics. They might know the family as the image that they portray, so they might not be able to see that these people can be this cruel, because the scapegoat is often only treated that way behind closed doors, because the family is trying to present an image, right? They might believe what the family does, that you did something to bring it on yourself, you know? And the truth is, sometimes if you're scapegoated, it's such a constant barrage of attack that sometimes you do lash out, or sometimes you do behave in ways that are not great because you do feel like a bad person. That also is not your fault. That's just a part of being human and how we react to being treated this way, right? So even when you don't behave in the best way, it's important to know that that's also not your fault. That's just, you know, everybody has their breaking point. And when you're taught to believe that you're a bad person, sometimes you might act like one. And that doesn't mean that you really are. So all of that goes into it as well. So I hope that helps.
So what made you write "It's Not Your Fault"?
Yeah, what really made me write it is I wanted people to have what I had learned. So I knew actually from writing a blog. So I'd started writing a blog in 2020 about this healing journey that I was on, about this dysfunctional family trauma that I was kind of parsing out and going through. And I was just making it public because I had so much shame around it, and I really felt I was hiding it. And it felt like in order to have an authentic life, I really need to be open about it and stop hiding it. And so I did that through the blog. And I'll tell you, at first, I was so afraid to do it publicly that I even thought about using a pen name and all kinds of stuff like that. But eventually I said, like, if you're going to be authentic, you got to use your real name. You got to just put it out there. And so I did this for myself. But what happened is I really garnered an audience of people who resonated with it, because like yourself, they saw themselves in it. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know that other people felt this way, because we're all hiding the shame of our families and how they treated us and everything, protecting the family at the expense of ourselves. So when I put it out there, I got all these people saying, oh my gosh, it's like you're reading my mind. Like, this is my family. This is what I'm going through. And so we helped each other to not feel alone. And so in building that audience on Instagram and through the mailing list and all of that stuff, that's where I got the audience for the book. Basically turned the blog into a book. You know, the book has a little more than the blog, and it's not all the same, identical, but a lot of the book is from the blog writing that I did. And that's really how it happened. It was just a desire to share what I was going through, because I felt like that's what I needed to do to have a really authentic life. And in that, finding all these people who completely resonated with it. So it happened quite organically in that way.
I love that. Is there one part of the book that you just felt like when you were writing it, that it spoke more? I know all of it spoke to you, but this particular part was like, I definitely have to get this in. I'm not going to stop till I finish this chapter or finish this, you know, because we get so passionate about our work.
I think it would probably be the scapegoating one, Yeah. And it's interesting that that also started with a blog post. And that was a blog post that went viral because scapegoating is one of those things that so many people go through and they don't realize how many other people are going through it mm-hmm. and how similar the experience is. Like sometimes I think dysfunctional families, they must have like some kind of hidden guidebook because they're all the same. It's like these patterns, it's like paint by numbers, you know, it's just identical. And that actually makes it quite easy to coach people who are going through this because I already know what to expect and what they're going through. But it's very interesting, very, very interesting how similar the dynamics are in these families, regardless of whether you're poverty stricken or rich, like socioeconomic status doesn't even play into it. It might, the situations might look different, but the dynamics behind it are always the same.
Yeah, I mean, because honestly, like I said, that's the one that, I mean, going through and listening to all of it, because I normally am a listener of books when authors come on, but I'm like, no, I've got to stop. And I'm highlighting in the book and I'm like, no. Oh, yeah, that's me. Oh, yeah, that's me too. And I finally gave up the yellow highlighter and just said, I'm going to switch to the Kindle version so I can just highlight it as I go along, because it was just so impactful. And it was like, you read my mind. You wrote my life story in your book.
Thank you.
How many people have come up and told you that?
Oh, I get emails every day. Like, I don't even know how many. Hundreds. I mean, thousands maybe, because of my Instagram. My Instagram got hacked, but it used to be around 50,000. And so I would get tons of DMs every day. I get emails every day of people saying just how much it means to them and the encouragement to keep doing what I'm doing. It really is such a wonderful support, and it feels so good when I receive those, because it just feels like you're impacting people's lives in a positive way, and there's nothing better than that.
Yeah, that's so true. Now, do you have your book with you?
I do. I have it beside me here.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a part of the book that you could read for us?
Yeah, sure. Since we're talking about scapegoating, I would probably read from that part. How much do you want me to, how long do you want me to read
for? However long you think you can read for.
Okay. So I'll start here. The scapegoat is the one who tells the truth about obvious defects in the family. Rather than support, the scapegoat experiences gaslighting from the rest of the family. That means your natural human reaction to the family's troubles or poor treatment of you becomes the focus instead of the issue itself. It is a form of psychological abuse in which the perpetrator denies or minimizes your experience. It's a cruel emotional manipulation that makes you doubt yourself and even reality. I know how this feels. One Thanksgiving, for example, I arrived home after traveling for hours in stormy weather to discover my family had eaten without me. When I asked why they wouldn't wait after I'd made such an effort to get there, my sister crossed her arms over her chest and growled, "Why do you always come in and make everybody feel like shit?" Then they returned to their conversation as if I had never spoken. Her gaslighting shut me up and put me in the role of the bad guy, even though I was the one who had been wronged. Sadly, the tactic worked, and I believed the lie that stating my feelings made me an irreparably horrible person. The family convinces the scapegoat that she is damaged, wrong, overreacting, and a liar. They make her question herself and even reality. She may be the mentally healthiest member of the family, but by banding together, the clan convinces itself and the scapegoat that the opposite is true. She or he is often the most creative, sensitive, and honest family member who is more willing to see and speak the truth behind the facade of the family image. She may not understand why the rest of the family is unwilling to admit the obvious, keeps secrets, and hides the truth. For the scapegoat, the truth will set you free, but she is part of a family system that would rather remain in chains. Is that enough or would you like more?
That is enough. I love that. The family system that they would rather remain in chains. And at one point, do you say, okay, I've had enough. I've got to put you at arm's length. And they still don't understand because they still think you're the one doing everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the hardest thing you'll ever do, but letting go of the belief that they will ever understand. I mean, if they ever do, it's not going to be because you did something. They might go and do their own work, and by some miracle, they do come to see the wrong of their ways. But you have to let go of that hope, because it's a false hope, and it started when you were a little child, and you had to have that hope in order to survive. But as an adult now, we can care for that child inside of us, and we can tell the truth that, yeah, no, these people are never going to understand. And it's important to know that their not understanding is part of what keeps the system going. So they're keeping a family system, a dysfunctional system going because they're afraid of change. They have to suppress you. They have to not understand you, because if they did understand you, they would be forced to change, and they can't face that. So that's what's going on here.
I mean, it's huge, especially around when you're like telling your family members, I just want you to, your feelings are valid, but please validate mine as well. Please tell me my feelings are valid, because everybody has a right to feel whatever they want to feel.
Yes. Feelings aren't right or wrong. Exactly.
So when people come to you and want to work with you, being a trauma-informed coach, what processes do you go through first to see if it's the right fit? Because, of course, every coach is different. Every person is different with a coach. And second of all, what's the process once they decide, okay, we're going to work with you now?
Yeah, so usually people, when they come to me, they already know they want to work with me. So we just have a short chat. Just to talk about, you know, I like to know like what they've done so far, you know, what kind of therapy have they done, things like that. And then I find out, you know, their history, like are they on antidepressants, you know, anything like that. Do they have any active addictions? And then it's just, is it a good fit? And it always is, because like I said, they know already that they want to work with me because I put so much content out there. I think it just gives a really good idea of who I am and what I'm about. And so usually by the time they come to me, they've tried everything. Like they've tried all the therapy, they've done all the things, or they've done the therapy and it's been good, but it's only got them to a certain point, and they want me to help them get to that life that is not just surviving, but is actually thriving. I mean, it sounds kind of cheesy when I say it like that, but that is like authentic, and they're growing and they're expanding and all of that stuff. Like being the person that they're really meant to be in this world. That's sort of what I get them to. And so we just have a 15-minute chat to figure that out. And then during our process, that varies according to the individual. So that's why I call it custom coaching. You can do 6 months, you can do 3 months. But during that time, we're going to deal with whatever arises in your life. And so how we deal with the small things is how you're going to deal with the big things as well, if that makes sense. And that inner child healing I talked about is a lot of it, the reparenting yourself. The nervous system soothing is a lot of it, because all of this starts in the body, and the mind can't talk the body out of what the body knows, right? More education. And then something I call mindful self-compassion is a big part of it too. So there's no tough love. There is only self-love and being kind to ourselves. Because often we've probably been very mean to ourselves. We said, why do you do that? All that sort of thing. We're going to reframe that. So instead of being mean to yourself, you might be curious, you know, like, why did I do that? Let's take a look at that. You know, you're always kind to yourself. Mindful means that we're accepting, not judging whatever's going on with us, especially our feelings. We learn to process our emotions. And most of all, we learn that it's not our fault, that what we grew up with was nothing to do with us, and that we need to let go and accept the limitations of our families, because they're not going to change, and nothing we do is going to make them change. We need to take all that energy we've been using to try and get those people to understand us, trying to prove that we're good, and we need to turn it onto ourselves and discover who we are, who we're meant to be in this world, and how we get there. So in a nutshell, that's it.
You said compassionate self-love. Can you give us some examples of that?
Yeah. So a big part of mindful self-compassion is really accepting your emotions. So you'd be amazed that when you start to learn to accept your emotions, how you might have never, ever done that before. We often, when we feel something that's quote unquote negative, like anger or sadness, we either deny it, we try to push it away, we try to talk ourselves out of it. And that's because we didn't get support around those feelings when we were a kid. So as an example, one of mine was disappointment. So I would not tolerate disappointment. I would not allow myself to feel it. I would give myself a pep talk that said, like, this is the way it's supposed to be. Other people have it worse, you know, all of that kind of stuff. That even if it's true, you're not acknowledging how you really feel in the moment. So what you need to do instead is experience that disappointment, comfort the child and say, yeah, this feels terrible. This is very disappointing. You know, I'm so sorry this didn't work out the way you wanted. It's not fair, things like that. Because you think about it, if a child came to you and said they felt sad, for instance, you wouldn't say, get over it, or go eat some ice cream or whatever it is you do when you feel sad to get it away from you. You would comfort it. You would give it a hug. You would say, they're there. And now you need to do that for yourself. And you might not understand that it matters now, but it does. Because when you push away feelings, you're denying a part of yourself. You're telling yourself you don't have a right to feel the way you do. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what your family has been telling you the whole time. So that's part of writing a new narrative for yourself too.
And writing the new narrative, you just said that word. And I was thinking on the question as you were talking about how if we don't fix ourselves, that you're going to pass it down to the next generation, how we break that generational curses when it comes to our children. Mm-hmm. I have three girls and I made a vow to be the type of mom that I didn't have growing up. Mm-hmm. My sisters had her, my two older sisters had her, yeah. My sister next to me and I didn't have that the same type of mom as they have. So our relationships were different, mm-hmm. but I vowed that I was not going to be like that with my girls because I wanted them to come to me how they were feeling. And even though I may be upset a little bit about what was going on, I still let them know that their feelings are 100% valid and that, yes, we will try harder to work better and work together to find a solution.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's really beautiful. And I think it's important too, because as parents who were raised in these dysfunctional homes, we have complex PTSD. That's a form of, you know, trauma that's been inflicted on you over and over again over a long period of time. That's childhood trauma, complex PTSD. So when we suffer with this and we become parents, we're incredibly hard on ourselves. And we think sometimes we have to be perfect to be a good parent. But what I want people to know is that they've done a lot of studies on this and they've realized that you only need to get it right as a parent about 30% of the time in order for your children to thrive. And that in fact, when you don't get it right, that can even be good for them because it gives them a chance to show resilience and problem solve and all of that, as long as it's not in a way that's overwhelming, like abusive, you know. And then if you do make a mistake, you can always come to your children and repair that in a way your parents never did. And that shows them that you respect them and you love them. And it can be even more powerful than if you got it right. So please know that you don't even have to get it right half the time to be an effective parent. And that shows you how low the bar is. And many of our parents didn't really even try. And that's why I take issue with when people say our parents did the best they could, because in many cases that is true, but in some cases it's not. And, you know, I think of myself as a young mom when I wasn't getting it right a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in an active addiction when my children were younger, but I did try. I was always reading parenting books. I was always doing my best. And I know my parents didn't do any of that. So, making any kind of effort as a parent is going to pay off. There is no need for anything close to perfection for your children to thrive. And I'm sure, Melissa, you can see the difference in your own kids. Like with mine, I just see the confidence mm-hmm. that they have, their willingness to ask for help. Just the sense you see with them that they know they deserve the best in life, you know, mm-hmm. and we didn't have that.
So. No, we didn't. As a matter of fact, there was a conversation that happened about a couple of months ago with my middle daughter, where she was telling me about something that happened in her childhood that I didn't recall happening. But the old me and the me that I grew up, the mom that I grew up with would have said, that didn't happen. You're lying, and really be accusatory. But with her, I said, you know what? I don't recall it happening, but you're telling me it did. So it must have happened in your eyes. That's how you felt. And I sincerely apologize as your mom that I did this. But as parents, we all make mistakes. Yeah. And my mom would never, even up until the day she died, would never admit that she ever made any mistakes. And I think being human, we all make mistakes.
Yeah. And that's because, Melissa, your true self is out. So your mother must have had like an ego self or a false self, whatever the narcissistic, you know, personality was that was covering up the true self. But because you're coming from a true self, you don't feel threatened by that. You know, you really do want to know the truth. Whereas with a false self, someone is always trying to cover up the truth and everything is a threat to them being exposed. And that makes it impossible to parent well.
Yeah. And I love the fact that you put in that 30% of parents do well, because I think that 30% of the time, because I think a lot of parents think they have to do it perfectly every time. Mm-hmm. And we need to take that kind of weight off our shoulders, because I think we would approach parenting so much at a different viewpoint if we know that we only have to get it right 30% of the time.
Absolutely. Yes. I'm sure that's very surprising to many.
Mm-hmm. That's 100. Now we're almost time to close out, but there's one last little nugget before we talk about where people can find you, that you want to share that you, maybe we didn't hit on, or something that we did hit on, but you want to make sure that people understood.
Yeah.
The floor is yours.
Yeah, I think I always come back to the title of my book, which is It's Not Your Fault. I really want people to know that healing is possible, even if you feel like you've tried everything, you've done all the self-help, you've done all the therapy. Like, don't give up and don't think that you're too old or it's too late for me, because healing can happen very rapidly. Even if you're 70 years old and you've been going through this your whole life, once you make that commitment to heal and you find the right help, even if you haven't found it in the past, things can happen. Like all that 70 years can start to be healed in a couple of years. It's not going to take 70 years to heal, you know, and you can have a very different life going forward and a life that you would never even have imagined for yourself. And it's just called having an authentic life. It's being authentic and not having to pretend and not having to hide or feel shame. That is what's available to you. And all you have to do is do the healing, get a little help with the healing. Never give up. That's what I would say.
Yeah. And I would totally tell you that's true, because it was at the point when I finally said, okay, you're in my life, but you're at arm's length. I can't have you constantly in my every day thing, because all it was doing was racking my mental and my physical health. And so once I did that, I became a whole different person. And the girls, my girls even noticed it, like in the last few years, like, mama, you're not as whiny as you used to be. You don't fly off the handle like you used to fly, you know, all these things, because I realized that I'm not going to take on anybody else's problems. What I've got is what I'm going to have to deal with, my immediate family, and that's it. I don't have the capacity to deal with anybody else at this point.
Yeah, and that's beautiful. That's a gift you gave yourself and your children, so that is really lovely.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. where can people find It's Not Your Fault?
Yeah, so I see you've got a link there. They can absolutely go there, laurakconnell.com/book, and you can... purchase it there. So you're going to click on the link on that page. It'll take you to, I think it's the Simon & Schuster page, which is the book distributor. And then you can choose who you want to buy it from, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you like to shop. And then once you've purchased the book, send me a screenshot of your order and I will give you a gift, which is valued at $100. And these are course materials along the lines of what we've been talking about today with some action steps you can take. And these can be really helpful to you on your healing journey. So I'll offer you that. All you have to do is pay $15.95 for the book, less than Amazon, I think. And I'll give you $100 worth of course material.
Wow. And where can people find you at?
Probably laurakconnell.com. That's where my home base is, my website. The menu will help you navigate through everything there. Very extensive blog library since 2020 on all these topics we've been talking about today and more. They're good quality because I'm a writer by trade, so you'll probably enjoy them and find what you're looking for there. So I think that's a good place to start. And then Instagram is laurak.connell.
Yeah, and I was telling you, there's a lot of Laura Connell on Instagram. I literally had to go to your page to tag you. I had to go to your actual webpage to find out which one was you so I could tag you in that Instagram post because I'm like, there's too many in there.
Right. I'm glad you found me.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for writing It's Not Your Fault, because I think it's an insightful book that everybody, honestly, I think somebody can take something from this book, even if it's just a little short snippet, because I identified with a majority of the book. And like I said, I'm halfway through the book right now and I identify with the majority of it. So, so thank you for coming on and for writing the book and for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And I'm really happy to hear how the book resonated with you. I'm really grateful that I got to connect with you today.
Okay, guys, I will put in the show notes everywhere you can find Laura, as well as finding her book. And with that, be blessed and remember, keep chatting. See you next time. Bye.
Chats from the Blog Cabin.
Hit subscribe
and don't miss the next episode.